damn late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
This is Anti-War Radio for Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin. Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. My guest today is Bill Brown. From the Surveillance Camera Players, the website is notbored.org. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks very much, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Well, video camera surveillance has been an issue of mine really even before it really got too widespread when they first started putting them in the convenience stores back in, say, the early to mid-90s. I kind of got my hackles up about it, and I've been watching the issue a lot ever since, or, well, probably not as much as I should, but I very rarely get around to covering it on the show. This is the kind of thing that bothers me to no end, and it's really the government cameras that I have a problem with more than, somebody trying to protect their own property. I see that you guys, basically since around the very same time, right, been around since 1996, according to your website.
That's right.
And basically what you're doing is spoofing these video cameras and doing plays and so forth to draw attention to them and call them out for what they're doing, right?
Exactly. Not only just for what they're doing, but the very fact that they're there.
Mm-hmm.
Too many of the cameras that are especially installed by the government, but especially in public places, too many of them don't look like cameras. They're little globe objects that many people think are lights or ornaments.
Right.
So they don't know that the cameras are there, and virtually none of them are accompanied by signs that say, warning, we're the police, or we're a security guard company hired by so-and-so. So that people never really know that there are cameras there. They have the general idea, but they don't know what they look like, and they have no idea how many.
Mm-hmm.
So that's right. The performances are not just calling out, you know, the cameras in general, but particular ones, so people can get educated to know what do these things look like and get an idea of how many there are, because especially in a place like New York and no doubt in Houston and especially in almost every American city, there are thousands and thousands of them, and the powers that be only want to add more of them.
Yep. And it's interesting. You talk about disguising them so they sort of look like lampposts and what have you. A friend of mine is actually living in England right now. And I asked him, so what's it like walking around London with millions of cameras pointed at you? And he says, millions of cameras? I didn't even notice at all. Didn't even know they were there.
That's right. I mean, by law, the English are supposed to put up signs. And apparently, a number of watchdog groups will say that only 1 in 4 of their cameras actually are accompanied by signs. And when I was there a couple of times in different cities, same thing, that we would make maps of the cameras and that where all the cameras were. And there were so many cameras, you could barely make a map of them. And again, people are not really focused on this issue just yet, where the English have already thought it's very 1990s, because that's when all the cameras went up there, and they don't realize how many cameras are watching them at all times.
Yeah, and it is sort of the thing where, well, I guess this has been my frustration since I was in 10th grade and read 1984 was, well, wait a minute, if this is, you know, the second or third most popular, most read book in America, then how could it be that we're all letting them do this to our society right in front of us when we've all read the book and know exactly what is happening here?
Well, I think it comes down to an idea that people either are very apathetic, either that, or they really don't put, you know, kind of draw connections between the various dots.
Mm-hmm.
And especially people who don't have a bad experience with the police or security guards think, well, they're not really doing anything wrong with the camera, so why should I worry? And the people who have actually had an experience of what the watchers are like or what the cops are like or the security guards are like know that they can't be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to trust them in general, and especially if they're able to zoom in, you know, they're hiding in some sort of little watcher's room with a little joystick that allows them to zoom in 15 or 100 times, you know that they can't be trusted. And that's why I think many people don't make the connection between 1984 and what's going on now, is that they don't really put all the dots together to see the bigger picture.
Right. Although, to me, it's just amazing that there's anybody in this country who's yet to have a negative experience with a cop.
Well, there's a lot of insulated people or just mark it down to a fluke rather than seeing this is just what some parts
right.
of the population go through day in and day out. So when we hand out maps of the cameras or do performances in different areas of the city, it's amazing to see the different responses, where especially here in New York, there's a big difference between tourist areas where people are afraid because they've been watching too much television. And then you go into the areas where people actually live and they say, oh, yeah, man, the police have got their boot on us all the time. And thanks for the maps. And the response is very, very different.
Oh, I see. It's the, you know, Times Square where everybody's scared and wants there to be cameras, and yet they're down every street in Brooklyn, too.
That's right. So that in Times Square, the tourists will say, I like that there are cameras. You can't find any locals in Times Square, and all the tourists say they like them. But go to Harlem, go to the Lower East Side, go to Brooklyn. They're all saying, I don't trust the cops. I don't trust the cameras. Thanks so much for doing this. You know, we're totally with you.
Well, you know, I don't mean to be too conspiratorial about it because I don't have any paperwork that says, you know, what they were talking about at the time or anything. But I know that when they very first started putting up the cameras here in Austin, Texas, that the very first thing they did was cover all the entrances to the city. Every road in or out of town, back road or otherwise, pretty much any way in or out of town from any of the neighboring towns, every road had, those were the places that got the cameras first. And that seemed to me to have a lot more with policing than traffic flow or what have you, you know, since a lot of those places weren't necessarily the heavy traffic areas, just
right. Well,
the main arteries, you know.
See, that's what's so significant about what's happened since September 11th is that the Department of Transportation at the federal level, that's part of Homeland Security.
Uh-huh.
So that when they put up DOT cameras, presumably, yes, they're just watching traffic and it sounds very benign. But what they're doing is you realize that anybody who comes into Austin, drives around Austin, here in New York as well, that way they can keep track of them, their cars, that is, wherever they go. And it sounds benign because it's only watching traffic, but it's a police function. And because DOT is really Homeland Security these days, it's also supposedly it's a Big Brother function.
Right. And you know, to think about the integration of the Department of Transportation with the national policing functions and so forth, is that really happening on the state levels, too, where the,
yeah,
say, the
absolutely.
Texas Department of Transportation is now part of some police agency?
It's part of the Department of Homeland Security. So here in both New York City and New York State, that's what DOT is. It's just been brought into Homeland Security. And their justification is that terrorists or the people that are called terrorists are either going to use mass transportation or target it. So that's why they put in most of the government money goes into Department of Transportation cameras. And that the next step from there, based on the English model, is putting software on those cameras that allow them to read and record license plate numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So that means if you come into Austin, say you're driving around, a machine reading your license plate can keep track of you wherever you've gone, when you entered the city, if you passed any of their cameras, and when you left it, completely automatically.
And see, that's a very important point, too, that they can have the same cameras that they've had up there since 1997, and it's all about the software.
If they have
the right software, it can recognize the digits on that license plate.
That's right. It's not the camera that gets upgraded. Although, I mean, it'd be nice if they had put down digital, for their purposes, if they had put down digital cameras to begin with. But it's the same thing, because it's a very cynical argument that they'd say, we're not putting in any new cameras. We're just updating the ones that we already have. So therefore, you're used to them, they tell us. So therefore, you shouldn't, you know, mind if they go from analog cameras to digital cameras, from cameras that are watched by people to cameras that are watched by machines and computers.
Well, you know what's interesting is when they first put the cameras up in Houston, which was, I think, about a year and a half before they put them up here in Austin, the first ones that they put up, they had them on the big towers on the freeway, you know, for the kind of long-range view. But then they also had a camera on, you know, specific signs over the highway. There would be three cameras pointed down at an angle to, you know, right at the back license plate, basically. And that was way back then. That was 10 years ago.
That's right. I mean, DOT has been planning what they call intelligence or an integrated system for a very long time. They've been doing it incrementally. And it can also make them money. And that's the current scandal here in New York, is that these aren't security cameras. They're scameras, as in they can be used for congestion pricing. So say you have to come into work from Brooklyn, you have to go into Manhattan. The cameras that are operated by DOT take a picture of your license plate and then send you a bill because you are contributing to congestion. And
That's
one of the ways that in England the cameras are used. The very ones that were supposedly anti-terrorist cameras are just used to be able to charge people for coming into the city using their cars.
Mm-hmm.
So that they've been planning this in Austin and New York for a very long time because the English have showed the way.
Uh-huh. You know, I wish I still had the videotape to get the audio from this to play, but I used to have, I guess I taped it, some kook had run this on the local access channel, and it was a Hughes aircraft promotional video for the smart highway system from probably 1994, something like that. And it was cameras everywhere and transponders in all the cars. And that's something that we have now here in Texas, where our fascist governor, Rick Perry, has forced the taxpayers of Texas to pay for these freeways, forced all the people off their land at gunpoint who were in the way, of course, forced all the people of Texas to pay for the freeways, and then sold them to foreign corporations and given them 25 or 75 years or whatever to tax us all by the mile and put tracking devices in our cars.
That's right. Exactly. So that the whole thing not only pays for itself, but makes profits for the people who have put these people into power.
We build the roads, and then they tax us by the mile anyway.
Right.
Insanity.
Right, exactly. And again, the British, unfortunately, have been ahead of us. Is in England now, all over the country, every single license plate comes with a transponder. And it's going to be the same thing here in the United States when they make a national registry or ID card based on your driver's license. And every single license plate is also going to be equipped with a transponder. So you get charged on the interstate highway system. And once again, it'll be the DOT and their cameras and their transponder readers that photograph your license plate, find out who you are, where you've been, and charge you.
And now you're predicting that, or that's in the Real ID Act?
No, it's actually in the process of being done.
Uh-huh.
It's just this is such a huge country, and there are so many different states with so many different laws. It has to be done over a period of, as we're talking about, a 13-year period since 1984. It's being made like a quilt, piece by piece, where in England they could throw it together because it's such a tiny, tiny country. They could do it quickly, but it's been in the process of being made here in the United States for the last decade.
All right, well, just to play devil's advocate, I'm sorry, because I know it sounds stupid, but, you know, if you don't have anything to hide, you don't have anything to worry about and all that.
Yeah, I get that a lot, and there's so many different ways of demolishing it. It's almost like a sport, which is, the classic example is this, is that, say, you're the French government, and it's 1939, and you've created a database of homosexuals, and this database, or it's actually a set of index cards, is simply to provide health services or some other function. And then what happens is that then the Nazis come in and take over the country. They use that very same collection of information to exterminate people. And the same thing could happen now with all of the cameras, all of the information, is that even though, yes, you have nothing, you're doing nothing wrong at this moment, the government could change or the law could change tomorrow, and what was innocent today is guilty tomorrow. And that's why we have to be very careful about cameras and everything else that collects information, is that they'll change the laws the next day so that every innocent, so-called innocent person is guilty.
And we've seen how they're already doing it in Iraq, making people scan their eyeballs and all their fingerprints, creating a database of Iraqis' eyeballs.
That's right.
The U.S. Exactly. Military.
That's right. And even if those Iraqis never come here, what they're doing is padding the pockets of the defense contractors who are spending billions of dollars making the software so that that way they're able to make their money back, institute it in warfare, and once they either get a trial run or prove, quote, that it's successful in Baghdad, then it gets used in Austin, then it gets used in New York City.
Well, and what an important point that is, the military-industrial complex. I see you have a list on your website here, BAE Systems from the United Kingdom, Boeing, Honeywell, Raytheon, certainly Lockheed's in on this.
Right.
And that is what we're talking about, really, is businessmen who aren't man enough to compete in a free market, and so instead they go to the captive market, the American taxpayer, and they pay congressmen, you know, maybe a couple million dollars, and then get hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars in return from those congressmen of our money.
Yes, that's right, and especially if they can do that on foreign soil where literally it's an occupying force, that there's nobody's going to compete with Halliburton or Boeing to be able to get these contracts in Baghdad. So that's right, they get a privileged deal out there, make their money back, and then they can turn around and sell it back to the Americans, to us, saying, well, it worked in Baghdad. It'll certainly work in stopping crime in, you know, the Fifth Ward of Houston or someplace that's been demonized as being sort of the Baghdad of America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost going to be the exact same people, Muslims in Iraq and then Muslims and blacks here in the United States. Those will be the same targets, whether it's the war on terror outside of the country or the war of terror inside the country. They will identify the very same enemies.
Mm-hmm. And the financial interest behind it, I hate to just continue harping on that, but it's, I guess, legendary here in Texas that the biggest supporters of the war on drugs are the concrete and steel bar manufacturers. And there's just no secret about it. who is for the government waging war on the American people? It's these certain politically connected private interests who stand to gain so much financially at the expense of all of our liberty.
Right. Well, that's why I've heard people say that it's not just the military-industrial complex anymore. It's the military-industrial prison entertainment complex.
Yeah, and security
all
complex.
All of them have a role. Yes, they all can make money out of making a spectacle out of the war on drugs, the war on terror, and they make money by making jails, and then they have to put people inside them.
Yeah, that's right. A mass without roofs, a prison to fill. Okay, so now tell me a little bit about your group. I like the idea of activist lefty types going out and putting on plays in front of these cameras. And tell me a little bit about how you guys call attention to the surveillance society.
Okay, well, first of all, as the group is, we're a very small little nucleus here in New York, and we've tried to organize ourselves as much by anti-authoritarian principles. So we don't have just like one leader with a hierarchy and have a mass organization. What we've tried to do is encourage people, if they like what we do, to found their own groups, either take the name Surveillance Camera Players or make up one of their own, so that all over the country and all over the world, little SCP groups have come and gone. So there's been one or two in Tempe, Arizona, San Francisco, weird places like Lithuania, Sweden, Greece, so that we try to not only have an anti-authoritarian message, but put it across in a way where we're not using the same techniques of the people that we dislike so much. And we try to be decentered and anti-authoritarian in our practice. So what all those little decentered groups do is basically collect and give out information. Where are their cameras? How do they work? How do they not work? How many of them are in certain places? And the plays get people to just stop. You know, they're walking around. They're thinking about, you know, their rent or their job or whatever it is. You get them to stop just for a moment, and in a moment, you put a flyer in their hands that shows not just is there one camera, but there's 300 in this neighborhood. So that's basically what we try to do, is organize ourselves in a decentered way and give people good, hard, useful information that they can then take with them.
Right. Well, and at the same time, you do kind of funny plays and have signs and all that kind of stuff. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's got to be something.
I'm trying to make this fun for the
stop.
Audience here.
Yeah, I mean, it's the play has to be. Well, I'm glad that you find the plays funny, because we try to make them ironic, funny, sarcastic, because especially in big cities, it's very hard to get people to pay attention to protesters, because people have almost been immunized not to listen to protesters. So we try not to look like protesters. We try to look like street performers, or people who are making, you know, sort of a gag-like point by praying to the cameras, pretending that they're God, trick-or-treating them, anything like that, to be able to get subliminally into people's heads so that they don't have any preconceived ideas and, bam, give them some information that they might not have known about any other way.
Yeah, well,
so humor is a big part of the plays. And we do, to go back to 1984, do a version of 1984, because it's the sort of thing that almost everybody recognizes.
Well, I kind of like the idea of the big fat security guard sitting there, you know, doing nothing all night. And then he sees this, and you guys are basically calling him out for the parasite that he is.
Yeah, exactly. As in, these people just sit in a room and they don't do anything. And part of what we're doing is saying, if you want to watch us, you can't do this on the cheap, or you can't do this and be a coward. You've got to come out and actually talk to us as people. And the interesting thing is that they don't. That they'll see us standing in front of their camera saying, we know you're watching, mind your own business. And they don't come out. They stay there as if they're afraid of us. So instead of us being afraid of them, we turn the tables and make them afraid of us.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, cops hate it when people point cameras at them. I mean,
yes,
private security guards is one thing, but a cop will, you know, you better look out. He doesn't shoot you and claim he thought it was a gun in your hand.
Yes, which is why we've got to be very careful, yes, especially with the cops. The security guards are one thing, but with the cops, that's why it's very good to be able to say to them, look, we don't really like what you're doing, but the cameras put them out of business as well. And that there's a difference between the rank and file cops, the people who are actually workers, you know, municipal workers, and then there's the unions and their bosses who want to put in cameras and replace cops or pay them much less money to watch the cameras. And you can sort of divide them in between themselves and say the rank and file is against cameras, but it's their bosses and their unions that are telling them you want cameras for the same reason that everybody else does, but they really don't.
Well,
they know the cameras will put them out of business, that they won't have a job anymore, or they'll have a bad job, which is nobody wants to sit in a dark room watching 50 screens. They'd much rather be out and talking to people, and you can use that against them.
Well, the bosses always are going to just be obsessed with the technology, especially as long as the military is giving it to them for free, which has been the standard for quite some time now.
And that's an important thing to tie together, is that people understand that surveillance cameras in public space, public places is literally not only military technology, it's a military style of watching. And if you go back to sort of some of the CIA documents that were just released, the so-called crown jewels, it shows that in the early 70s, the CIA was providing, you know, police departments in Washington, D.C. with surveillance cameras. So that it's the source of all this stuff, the very, very first cameras that went in to public places around 1970 came from either the CIA or the military to fight against the anti-war movement back then. And nothing has changed in 37 years.
Yep. And, you know, that really goes to the heart of it, too, because, you know, government action against the anti-war movement is the perfect example of them using these kinds of powers to protect themselves. That's what fighting the anti-war movement was about. There was nothing criminal about being an anti-war movement. This is America, for crying out loud. You can peaceably assemble and petition for redress of grievances and tell your congressman he better do what you say or he's fired and all the rest of that stuff. So the only purpose they had in deploying this kind of these kinds of things against the anti-war movement was to oppress Americans and remove them from their rights.
That's right. And in that way, the war that they fight is always on two fronts, against an enemy that they've basically convinced us is our enemy when they're not, and an internal one at the same time.
Let me ask you this. If they had put up cameras all over the place around that same time in 1970, where everybody could see them and everybody knew where they were, or, you know, they were at least, I guess, as obvious as they are now, how different would the reaction have been, do you think, to the way it is now?
It's a great question, and I think the reaction would be much different and much more outraged back then, and that basically what's happened is that the society has gotten so good at seducing people and doping them up with reality television and Paris Hilton and cheap gas prices and just all the way that the media can manipulate people. They manipulate people much better now than they did 30 years ago. So 30 years ago, 35 years ago, I think people would have had a much different approach, much more angry and direct one, and now people are mostly asleep.
I have to say I agree with that. I was only a little kid at the time, but, you know, just my overall impression of the, you know, grown Texas gentlemen that I knew as they existed in the early 1980s, it seems to me like the kind of thing where they would have gone inside and grabbed their rifle. You know, this is not going to stand. Come on, boys, let's grab our pitchforks and torches and head on down to the Capitol building and put an end to this right now.
Yes, that's right. And things have really changed. And to my mind, it's the media in all of its forms that has gotten very good at keeping people both stupid and passive.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, The conservative, that right-wing conservative, at least here in Texas, leave me the hell alone attitude, was responsible for, in I think 97 or 98 or sometime, the Texas legislature they were basically passing a law legalizing the authority of the cities and counties and so forth around Texas to begin putting up red light cameras. And it was a very right-wing, crusty old conservative, if I remember right, in the Texas Senate, who added an amendment that said, okay, you can do this, and he successfully added the amendment, you can do this, but you have to put up a giant poster of Vladimir Lenin, and it has to say, Big Brother is watching you at
That's
every
right.
corner where you do this. And, of course, that was the poison pill that killed the bill. But is there anybody in the Texas legislature who would stand up like that today? I don't think so. And they've
Probably
already,
not,
they're moving that way right now here.
There's one or two of these people. Like, I remember Dick Armey teams up with the ACLU to fight against surveillance cameras. So you do get libertarians on the right who hook up with libertarians on the left. And those are people that it's very hard to make connections, but we need to make connections between them. So I remember several years ago, a militia, a kind of right-wing militia in Michigan, made a link to our site, the surveillance camera player site, and they were saying, look, you know, we may disagree about the Second Amendment, the one about guns, but we agree about the Fourth Amendment, which is that the government does not have a right to take away our free speech rights and to be able to just put up cameras everywhere. So there are people who are left, right, and center who are just anti the government and this kind of Leninist way of saying, we know what's good for you. And the trick is maybe making alliances without selling ourselves out,
mm-hmm.
you know, without buying into their racism or whatever it is that the other things that go on with it. But I think these people are fewer and fewer because they're there. They've got to be there, but they're just keeping quiet. And the key is getting people to speak up and say, you really don't like the speed cameras. We don't like the cameras at red lights, and getting them to speak up because there's more of us. I'm convinced of it. There's more of us who are against this. It's just that people have been taught to be quiet, and we've got to teach people not to be quiet, but to speak up.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. There are a lot more people of all different persuasions, and even people who don't really study or follow politics at all, who would try to object to this if they thought there was an effective way to do it.
Well, but that's the thing. It's the first thing is just to get to people who realize that we're not alone and that it's only a little minority that outshouts everybody else or just convinces everybody else just to be quiet. And the key thing that I hope surveillance camera players is doing is saying, just speak up. And once you speak up, you may find out that people agree with you. So we've had very, very peculiar people who agree with us. As I said, you can't predict it. And it's not people who necessarily agree with us that you think would agree or the people that would disagree.
Yeah, well, if there's one unifying issue in this country, I hope it's the Bill of Rights, all 10 of them. And I know that the 9th and the 10th have never really existed. But, you know, the first 8 were around for a while there. And, you know, I'd sure like to keep them if I could.
That's right. But as you know, we've got a president who doesn't believe that habeas corpus should be a right. And I was reading someplace, you remove habeas corpus, and that the entire Bill of Rights collapses.
That's right.
And that we've got to defend not only the Bill of Rights, but habeas corpus, so that way you can actually say, people, you can't hold me indefinitely. You've got to charge me with something or let me go.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, let's finish up here a little bit with kind of, you know, we talked about the changes in our society that have allowed this to happen, and particularly the influence of the media telling you to care about anything except what's important. Which is obvious enough, but I want to get back to finish up here. I want to get back more to the idea of the kind of society, not so much the one we're living in right now, but the one we're headed towards in, say, 5 or 10 years, where all these things that you and I are discussing now, that you've been discussing here at notbored.org for a good 10 years or more, what is it going to look like when all these systems are integrated? When the camera that takes a picture of our license plate, you know, is integrated right to the database that, you know, says whether we're behind on our taxes or whether we have a, you know, a speeding ticket or any old thing, when all the products at the stores are talking to the mainframes, when all the or great many more of these cameras are all online and integrated together into central databases. It reminds me of the story, and I hope I'm saying it right, because I it's been a long time and I kind of forget, but is it the Panopticon, the prison design, where there's a central tower in the middle and none of the prisoners are able to tell if they're being watched at any given moment, so the impression is that they are? And that kind of, I mean, that's a model for how to build a prison.
Well, I think it's something like that, only much more modern. And I think you were getting there, which is that the society we're going to is that everybody has a number, not just prisoners who always have a unique number, but every citizen, which means that there's no hiding, there's no way of having any privacy whatsoever, because it's as if people are going to walk around now with their numbers tattooed on them, and either that's your license plate number, your cell phone, or either a identifying card, your license plate, and that way, once the government is able to give a unique number to every single person and have all the mainframes controlling people, that's where the society is leading. And it's, to me, it looks like social death. It looks like an absolute dystopia where everybody knows everything about everybody else, and that there's no way of hiding or having a private moment, because they've literally given you a number and they have your number. And they'll be selling you things, and everybody will know if you're behind on your taxes or if you skipped out on your student loans or if you once were arrested for smoking a joint someplace. Everybody will be completely naked, informationally naked. And to my mind, it's something that's not 5 or 10 years away. It's more like 3 years away. In England, the surveillance net that they have there, they put together basically between 96 and 99. And America is moving under Bush that quickly to make sure that every human being in America basically has the equivalent of a number that can be visible to everybody else, or especially to the government and all the corporations that support it.
Now, besides, like, you know, your specific actions and things that you're doing, which I think are just absolutely commendable, what do you think should be the target of people who are opposed to this? How do we oppose it? Because, you know, we can't go Ted Kaczynski and try to, you know, undo technological advancements and stuff. The computer chips are just going to keep getting faster and faster. These kinds of technologies are going to keep getting cheaper and cheaper. Is not the problem, from my point of view, and I'm a libertarian, free market kind of guy, I tend to think that the biggest problem here really is state power, and that ultimately private business will find it not profitable to treat us all like cattle, because we don't like that. We become unhappy customers that way, whereas the state, it seems like they're the ones really pushing this, and of course, they're the ones who have the authority to kidnap us and kill us.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you about that. To the point there about basically the corporations want to make us happy so they can sell us stuff, but the government doesn't have to sell us anything. They just have to keep control.
Right.
And that I guess that the basic answer is learning how to break up power. That I've always thought that what the United States needs is to devolve into its real regions. That this is a very, very varied country that's been artificially brought together into this thing called the United States of America. And that basically a secession movement would be one of the most effective things, is break the United States up into natural, like, biospheres. That everybody knows that, you know, there's a special vibe that goes on in the Northwest. Instead of pretending that the Northwest has the same vibe as the Northeast, make them separate countries, and thereby limit what political power can do by going back to being a country of states instead of a country of a federal government.
Oh, Bill Brown, you are a man after my own heart. Did you hear that, everybody? Reinstate the Articles of Confederation. That's where we screwed it up, right? Was listening to Alexander Hamilton and them.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I just saw that they released the so-called Anti-Federalist Papers.
Yeah.
And Thomas Paine was a very big, you know, Thomas Paine, give me liberty or give me death, was very big on limiting the size of the federal government. I think history has proved him right.
Absolutely. All right. What a great interview. Bill Brown from the Surveillance Camera Players. They have a book. You can find it online. We Know You Are Watching. The Surveillance Camera Players, 1996 through 2006. The website is notbored.org. Thanks very much for your time today, Bill.
My pleasure, Scott. Good talking to you.
Life was too short, but now it's kind of funky. I make the beats for me and my homies. Newspaper reporters and others always ask me why I'm X-rated and I rap so nasty. When I was a teen, I did nothing else but pick pick up a pen and express myself. The things I wrote while I'm singing it kind of dirty, but mama always said the truth couldn't hurt me. She also said that it would set me free. I guess she was all I-G-H-T on the nail, cause now I'm out making my mail. It all started out from a freaky tale. If that's what sells, then I'ma stick with it. Short dog ain't changing, so forget it. You can sell out if you want to, homie, but I'ma stay short but funky. Verse 2, it's Short Dog Baby from the Dangerous Crew. Not your average everyday fake rapping the micro. I might say something that your mother don't like, so don't play it loud when she's around to see. But you can play this cause it's rated PG. When I'm rated X, I'm just having my fun. I bring a smile to each and every one, but there's a serious side to everything I say. Life is too short for you to wait till the next day. Just straighten up your life and you can start right here. Drop the cocaine and the bottles of beer. People always say it ain't right to preach, but take my advice, get wise and reach for the sky. So you can live like a king, homie, and I'ma stay short but funky. Catch me on the mic rapping a dance tune. I like it kind of mellow with the sound of the bass boom. The style is mine, I've been doing it for 10. You might say it's simple, but I'm making my ends. See, I don't trip on a punk cause I jack them. Too short plus the cuss words equals platinum. What would I look like dancing on the stage? I wave my hand and do it like the old days. But some dumb fools wanna take it out of hand. With 50 million dancers and a big old band, that ain't me. I'm from the old school. Play the instrumental, get the mic, and I'm cool. Cause I'm a Uptown Mac, and it's like that, so it all comes out in my records in my stage show. In my category, I'm the one and only, and I'ma stay short but funky. Baby Jesus. From the Dangerous Crew.
All right, everybody. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio, 92.7 and 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, streaming live worldwide on the internet, kaos959.com. And that interview was Bill Brown from notbored.org, and they are the surveillance camera players. And one quick note, at the very end there when he was talking about the Anti-Federalist Papers, I'm pretty sure he meant Patrick Henry when he said Thomas Paine there, although I don't know what the hell. For all I know, Thomas Paine was against the Constitution too. I'd have to ask Anthony Gregory or something. It's been too long since I read that stuff. Anyway, though, yeah, it was Patrick Henry who said, "I smell a rat." Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so this is Anti-War Radio, and of course, in association with antiwar.com, and I think finally, or maybe not soon enough, the link will be just antiwar.com/radio, which will be much more convenient than how it was. My blog is thestressblog.com. Join in the fun at the stress blog. We like to sit around and make fun of Bill Kristol. It's a great time. And, yeah, antiwar.com, best place to go to find out what the hell's going on in the world every day. And we're not a bunch of belly gazing hippies either. Yeah, so hey, good news to start out this section of the show. Congressman Ron Paul, Dr. Ron Paul, representing District 14 in South Texas, the anti-war Republican. Not a Republican saying, oh, gee, I've learned my lesson. I've changed my mind. Sorry for going along with the president, but it was so important to me that I go along with the president. No, 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 not him. There's no such Ron Paul as that. This would be the Ron Paul who opposed the war in Iraq from 1998 all the way through today, consistently. And that was, of course, when Bill Clinton, the Congress passed, and Bill Clinton signed the Iraq Liberation Act. Well, the news is that the anti-war Republican, the man that Giuliani denounced and demanded he retract his statement that it's possible that American foreign policies have consequences, when we know that that's a fairy tale, in the second Republican debate, Ron Paul, the anti-war Republican, according to the presidential candidate finance reports, through the end of June of this year, raised more money from members of the military than any other Republican. And of course, we all know the military slants heavily Republican, although I'm sure many caught in the false left-right way of looking at collectivist politics will, you know, go over to the Democrats and vote for Obama or some crap like that. But apparently, of the military members who can still stomach having anything to do with the Republican Party at all after its betrayal of them, they are all supporting Paul. And in fact, Ron Paul is not just in first place among members of the military donating to campaigns. He has more than half of the total. If this was a nine-way election by dollars of military donors, Paul would not just have won with a plurality, he would have just won the majority vote out of nine Republican candidates. He's got more than half. McCain in distant second place. Paul and McCain, of course, being the only two who were actually members of the military. Ron Paul was a flight surgeon. Stationed out of Korea during the Vietnam War. Yeah, the rest of them, apparently the military doesn't care at all for Mitt Romney or Rudy I Was There That Day Giuliani or Hunter Huckabee Tancredo Brownback Thompson or any of the rest of them. I like this. Brownback has raised $71 from the Army. That's it. Ron Paul with over $23,000 from members of the military. McCain in second place with... almost getting close there, McCain, to $16,000. Booyah to the war party. How do you like that, war bloggers? Oh, well, if you're against the war, you hate the troops. Support the troops. Keep them in the desert dying for nothing. You're a traitor to America and a traitor to the soldiers if you oppose the war. Well, that's funny, because the anti-war Republican has raised more than half of all money donated to Republicans by members of the military. Now, if only that fact was enough to somehow make all those war party cheerleaders choke on their false assertions about the hatred of the troops on the part of the people who opposed the war. Wouldn't that be funny if from now on, anytime anyone tried to say that if you don't support the war, you're betraying the troops, that they would choke to death on their own lies, on their own ignorance and stupidity, or maybe just, you know, till they passed out, maybe fall, you know, scrape an elbow or something. I think that would be funny if they would have to literally choke on those words. should have admitted it to yourselves, all of you, in March, April, at the latest May 2003. There were no weapons. This was all lies. They said for 9 months straight that they had, you know, Superman intelligence, that they knew exactly where the weapons were, that they knew there were weapons. And when it was clear there were no weapons to be found, after a month or two of looking around the country, you should have all admitted you'd been lied to, you fell for it, just like when, you know, somebody does a magic trick for a little child. Should have admitted that and been for bringing the troops home from their betrayal in the desert ever since then. I don't know what everybody's waiting for. If we leave, it's going to get worse. Does anybody even believe that? I was reading Editor and Publisher, and they say that Richard Mellon Scaife, one of his newspapers, in their editorial, has come out questioning Bush's mental stability and basically laughing, jeering at the idea that somehow if we leave, there will be bloodshed in Iraq. Pardon, but 158 were killed yesterday. As the headline on antiwar.com reads today, just another day in Iraq, over 100 dead. And now, Tex McRae, who I'm so happy to have back on the blog at antiwar.com. We have missed you so much, Tex. You rule. Tex writes on the antiwar.com blog, a raw look at the surge. Sorry, I got a wisdom tooth out. And I haven't quite figured out how to say S's without my old wisdom tooth. I'm working on it. Tex McRae writes, a raw look at the surge. Maybe this is why they're supporting a candidate that promises to bring them home. And block quote here, leading to an ABCnews.com story. American soldiers describe the constant stress of living in a war zone, voice their frustrations over the politics with war strategy in Washington, and are seen as they watch an armored vehicle burn with six of their fellow troops trapped inside, in a rare and raw look at what American troops are experiencing on the front lines in Baghdad. Why should that be a rare look? Why is it that America, the land of the First Amendment, America that's going around killing all these people in the name of setting them free, why is it that we don't see this stuff all the time? We know it's been happening all the time. We know there are well over 3,600 dead Americans so far. Why is it that this is a rare and exceptional look, ABC News, that we even get to see this? And what is it? Oh, American soldiers standing and watching helplessly as six of their fellow soldiers burn to death inside an armored vehicle. Which I guess they're lucky to get. If you saw the USA Today front page yesterday, then you know that as the American soldiers are begging for armored vehicles, they're going to the Iraqi army instead, and Americans are still left to patrol around in aluminum Humvees. That's called supporting the troops. Sending them to a desert to patrol landmine central in aluminum Jeeps. That's supporting the troops. See? Okay. I challenge anybody in Congress to do my rotation, said Specialist Michael Vassell of Apache Company. They don't have to do anything. They just come and hang out with me and go home at the times I go home and stay here for 15 months with me. Apache Company was sent to Iraq in June 2006 for a 12-month rotation, which has since been extended to a 15-month tour. Quote, it's a joke. We will have spent 14 months in contact, basically fighting all 14 months, said Corporal Joshua Lake. Our battalion got right to Baghdad. First week we were in Baghdad, we lost two guys in our battalion. It hasn't stopped since. Because we have people up there in Congress with the brain of a two-year-old. Again, I'm now quoting Corporal Joshua Lake. I guess he's a self-hating soldier who hates himself and hates all his best friends and hates his country, and that's probably why he's in the military, right? Because obviously he hates everything that is good, true, and beautiful when he makes a statement like, because we have people up there in Congress with the brain of a two-year-old who don't know what they are doing, they don't experience it. I challenge the president or anyone who has us for 15 months to ride alongside me, Vassal said. I would do another 15 months if he comes out here and rides along with me every day for 15 months. I'll do 15 more months. They don't even have to pay me extra. And then there is a photo of an American armored vehicle upside down, burning, with soldiers apparently with some sort of firefighting gear on their backs attempting to put the fire out as six of their buddies burned to death in there. Tex McRae continues on the antiwar.com blog here. This is an unusually hard-hitting article. See the video also on the upper right-hand corner of the linked page, and also links to the rest of the photos. Well, that's what's happening to American soldiers all the time over there. And I know that, you know, it's not that bad for you if you can't hear them screaming as they burn to death from here. But it seems to me like a betrayal, an absolute betrayal of the American soldiers to have them left in this position still. Still. And now here's that article from editor and publisher. This is the links in the frontline section today at antiwar.com. Scaife-owned newspaper calls for Iraq troop withdrawal. Questions Bush's mental stability. Oh, did I forget to give out the number? If anybody wants to call in, it's 646-6446. And if you're calling from out of town, 512-646-6446. This is the editor and publisher staff here. New York, the Pittsburgh newspaper owned by conservative billionaire Richard Mellon Scaife yesterday called the Bush administration's plans to stay the course in Iraq a prescription for American suicide. The editorial in the Tribune Review added, quote, and quite frankly, during last Thursday's news conference, when George Bush started blathering about sometimes the decisions you make and the consequences don't enable you to be loved, we had to question his mental stability. It continued, President Bush warns that U.S. withdrawal would risk mass killings on a horrific scale. What do we have today, sir? If the president won't do the right thing and end this war, the people must. The House has voted to withdraw combat troops from Iraq by April, which is, of course, obviously another year from now and has a million exceptions to it. But still, the Senate must follow suit. Our brave troops should take great pride that they rid Iraq of Saddam Hussein, and they should have no shame in leaving Iraq, for it will not be in any way an exercise in tail tucking and running. America has done its job. It's time for the Iraqis to do theirs. Again, this is from the right-wing Pittsburgh Tribune Review. The editorial said it agrees with its local congressman on this, Democratic U.S. Representative John Murtha, who, of course, has been an American traitor for the last 2 years for saying this exact very thing. Scaife has been a loyal backer of Republican politicians and many conservative causes and funded a network of investigations into Bill Clinton in the 1990s. Yes, you all remember Scaife and Brock and Boy Clinton and all that crap. Isn't he a Weekly Standard kind of guy? Anyway, so there you go. Editor and publisher reporting that the Scaife-owned Pittsburgh Tribune Review is questioning Bush's mental capacity when he says things like, well, sometimes you do things that don't enable you to be loved because of, you know, the terrible consequences. Yeah, it seems like if he was mentally stable, he at least, you know, would keep his trap shut and not say stuff like that. I guess not. Maybe he's stable, but just not bright enough. You know, have they ever considered that? So anyway, there you have it. You wonder why Ron Paul is leading the collection of donations from military members, the anti-war Republican. You wonder why he's doing so well. Maybe it's because the war really is an absolute disaster, just like all the people who've been saying it's an absolute disaster have been saying for the last 4 years. That's what I really would like to see. I don't want him to say my name. Nobody knows who I am, really. But I would like to see, you know, some giant, I don't know, full-page story on the front page of the Post and the Times, where they go through and they cite all the people who were right about this war. all the people who they helped the war party level accusations against. And there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. Prominent critics, writers, former government officials, whistleblowers. All the reasons to oppose the war in Iraq that are being cited now are the same reasons that people were saying don't do it before the war. You know, the neocons at the Scaife newspapers who are just figuring this out, they're not looking at any new information. The same thing's been going on as has been going on. America's policy is backing the Iran factions in Iraq, and it doesn't work that well. The Sunnis still apparently don't want to live under the domination of the Iranians. Can you imagine that? This is the policy we've been following for 4 years. And all the people who were against this war before it even happened, they cited this. They said, yeah, but what about Iran next door? Isn't that going to be a big lid taken off their pressure cooker if we get rid of Saddam? And what about Al-Qaeda? There's no real ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, but won't this create a failed state and a battleground for Al-Qaeda to further radicalize and recruit and train new jihadists? What about the Kurds and the Turks? Are we going to let the Kurds break off and have their own independent Kurdistan? And then what about the wars with the three neighboring states that have massive Kurdish populations? Obviously, in a perfect world, they'd all go get to join their sovereignty with Kurdistan if they wanted to. But you think Turkey's going to put up with that? Or Iran or Syria? Just setting up for more war. And, you know, I'll tell you what, just coincidentally happens to be, go look at the speeches of Dr. Ron Paul in the lead up to the war. Go to his archives at antiwar.com and go click more and more and more at the bottom three or four times until you get back to the summer and the fall of 2002. Read Ron Paul's article, Questions That Won't Be Asked About the War in Iraq. And of course, he meant except by him. And, well, you know, within the government, he was the only one anyway. I don't know. I'd like to see a gigantic article called Antiwar.com and All Their Fellow Travelers Vindicated. Everything they've said all along has been right. The Independent Institute, the Future Freedom Foundation, the guys over at the Mises Institute, a lot of the left-wingers, you know, even at Common Dreams and Truth Out. I guess Truth Out's kind of new, but government experts like Scott Ritter, Colleen Rowley, the FBI whistleblower. Wow, that was quite a thunderclap there. Yeah, wow. Gee, this was so loud it was distracting. Could you guys hear that? Dang, it sounded like lightning hit right outside. Yeah, so anyway, and Michael Scheuer certainly was making this case inside the CIA, and since he left the CIA, he's been making this case publicly, that American policy is completing the radicalization of the Islamic world, something that bin Laden tried to do but couldn't do. And yet we're completing the radicalization of the Muslim world, and that's, you know, from Kosovo to Indonesia. I don't know how much problem they have in Indonesia. But pretty much, you know, grab the average guy off the street in a Muslim country and ask him what he thinks of, well, not just what he thinks of the United States of America, but what he thinks the role of his religion is in fighting to defend his land and so forth. All these concepts are being mixed up by American policy. And the headline yesterday from the LA Times was that more than half of the jihadists, in fact, here, I have the article right here, don't I? Saudi's role in Iraqi insurgency outlined, Sunni extremists from Saudi Arabia make up half of the foreign fighters in Iraq, many suicide bombers. Ned Parker, Times staff writer, this July 15th, 2007, Baghdad, although the Bush administration officials have frequently lashed out at Syria and Iran, accusing it of helping them, I guess it means, he means, of helping insurgents and militias here. The largest number of foreign fighters and suicide bombers in Iraq come from a third neighbor, Saudi Arabia, according to a senior U.S. military officer and Iraqi lawmakers. Yeah, we already knew that, didn't we? Did anybody think that all the foreign fighters were coming from Iran? When we're backing the Iran factions? I guess, they're foreign fighters, all right, but they're our allies. They're not part of the insurgency. About 45% of all foreign militants targeting U.S. troops in Iraq and Iraqi civilians and security forces are from Saudi Arabia. 15% are from Syria and Lebanon. 10% from North Africa, according to official U.S. military figures made available to the Times by a senior officer. Nearly half of the 135 foreigners in U.S. detention facilities in Iraq are Saudis. Fighters from Saudi Arabia are thought to have carried out more suicide bombings than those of any other nationality, said the senior U.S. officer, who spoke on condition of anonymity because of the subject's sensitivity. It is apparently the first time a U.S. official has given such a breakdown on the role played by Saudi nationals in Iraq's Sunni Arab insurgency. And see, this is not new. We knew 2 years ago, the Christian Science Monitor and the Boston Globe both reported on studies done independently of each other by an Israeli think tank, or an Israeli university think tank, and the Saudi government, which tracked the foreign fighters who went to Iraq to fight, the vast majority of which then were from Saudi Arabia. And also they concluded the Israelis and the Saudis independently of each other at nearly the same time, that virtually all of the foreign fighters who went to Iraq to fight were new recruits. They were radicalized not even by the occupation of their country by American combat forces bombing Iraq from their desert, but the invasion of Iraq itself. That was what had made these people join the ranks of the movement, so to speak. The only role, according to the Saudis and Israelis 2 years ago, the only role that the guys, the old Arab army, Arab-Afghan Mujahideen force from the 80s, or even from the 90s in Bosnia, only things they had to do with it was sending the new kids. They helped organize. But they weren't the ones going to fight in Iraq. And, people wonder, I wonder, why it is that Americans still believe, the last numbers we reported on this show was 41%, and it may be more than that. I could swear I saw something that said 60%, but maybe that's not right. I don't remember what it was. I think it was on TV. But anyway, a couple of weeks ago, we reported that 41%, at least, still, of course, it was more than 70% on the eve of the war against Iraq, but 41% of Americans still think that Saddam Hussein was responsible for September 11th, that Iraq had anything to do with the attack on America or the Al-Qaeda network that carried it out. And a big part of the reason for that is because, of course, our government keeps saying that the enemy in Iraq is Al-Qaeda. And that, and they just keep saying it over and over and over again, and I guess people just aren't paying much attention, and they think, well, if it's Al-Qaeda in Iraq, then it's Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they're not, trying to think critically and say, well, wait a minute, though, haven't I heard a million times that that was actually all lies? So, oh, I get it. All I had to do was, think about it for a moment without even bothering to Google and figure out that now there's Al-Qaeda in Iraq because America invaded that country, overthrew its government, and turned the place upside down, destroyed their society, and basically made the whole country a battlefield. Now there's Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They used to be called Anar al-Islam, and their enemy was the government of Jordan. They weren't Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had met with bin Laden and turned him down and said, no, I don't want to be part of your war against America. I want to go kill the king of Jordan. And bin Laden told them to go piss off then. And they had no relationship. Zarqawi was in Kurdistan, which cannot even really be considered Iraq on the eve of invasion, in terms of Saddam Hussein's power and authority. We had the no-drive, no-fly zones up there. Kurdistan was already autonomous. That was basically American territory in northern Iraq. And as Jim Mikleshevsky has written, and many other great reporters such as Chris Floyd have followed up on, they had a chance to kill Zarqawi. The U.S. military asked George Bush's White House for permission to kill Zarqawi, I think it was 7 times before the war started, because the military guys, not being political in their agendas, are saying, well, look, if the politicians have decided we're doing this war and we know we have this terrorist guy up in the north here, let us kill him before the war starts, because he's going to be a threat to our guys. Well, as Jim Mikuláczewski reported at NBC News, he's been their Pentagon reporter for, what, 20 years, 25, something like that. As he reported, no, the White House needed their excuse. They needed the lie that Iraq was tied to al-Qaeda, and Zarqawi, even though he was not tied to Saddam or al-Qaeda, was within the line on the map, not within the control of Saddam Hussein, not in any form of alliance with Saddam Hussein or his government whatsoever, other than there was a catch this guy and imprison him order sent out by Saddam's government, who had, again, little to no control at all over what was going on up in the Kurdish regions. And the White House needed their excuse. They needed to point at someone and say, see, al-Qaeda in Iraq. And that's why the military was forbidden to kill Zarqawi when they could have killed him easily before the war started. And that's why the group that became, at the very end of 2004, more than a year and a half after the invasion, it was only then that Zarqawi claimed, allegiance to bin Laden, etc., and renamed his group al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. But, so there you have it. The American people still so brainwashed, apparently from birth, into believing that if anyone becomes elected to the presidency, that they become Jesus. They become a saint. They are smarter than all of us, more talented than all of us, more moral than all of us. They are Superman. And anything they do is right, and it couldn't possibly be any other way, etc. People are so brainwashed into that way of thinking that they can't accept that America is an imperial aggressor who invaded a country that never attacked us and mass murdered the people there and destroyed their society. No. It must have been in self-defense somehow. It must have had something to do with something that made it okay. I know, yeah, Saddam and 9/11, right? That must be it. You have literally almost half of the American people who believe that Saddam Hussein did that. They have to come up with a way to cure that cognitive dissonance. Either Dick Cheney and George Bush are war criminals who they supported, or Saddam must have done 9/11. I know, I'll go with Saddam must have done 9/11. That's a lot easier on my conscience. Anyway, this is Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas. I guess I should play some music for you guys.
Island of Austin! But the very best no MC can say.
Skills and dope lyrical coasting, relying on talent, not marketed and pre- your ass crack cocaine, go blast that. Conjure that ass that hyper type of flashback. I publish like ass cap lyrics for hand clap. No pass rapping, you tracking, talent lacking. MC's more worried about their financial backing. Steady packing the gap as if something's gonna happen, but it doesn't. They wind up shooting their cousin, they bugging. I appear everywhere and nowhere at once. I know my style is bumping, even though some people front. It's the god of rap, you heard of it. The one that rhymes for the sky, giving airplanes mad turbulence. And rap tournaments, I reign permanent. Don't you think by now the number one spot, I'm not concerned with it. The course of rap, I'm turning it. Back to that good old-fashioned way of getting cash money by earning it. No bogus, hocus pocus, I bring back the focus. Skills, if you notice, my position is bonus. Now quote this, MCs are just hopeless. Thinking record sales make them the dopest. Yes, yes, y'all, you don't stop. KRS-One, rock on. Yes, yes, y'all, you don't stop. KRS-One, rock on.
Anti-war radio in Austin, Texas. This is from NetX News. Ron Paul puts the love in revolution. Who is Ron Paul? Why are random signs hanging around Utah County advertising a Ron Paul revolution? These are a few questions that usually come to mind with confronted by the unique, curiosity-provoking signs where the letters E-V-O-L are spelled backward in a different color than the rest of the word revolution. I realized when looking in my rearview mirror at it that it spelled love if read from right to left. I asked a few of my friends if they recognized the name Ron Paul to see if I could discover the source of the seemingly spontaneous evolution of the Ron Paul revolution. Was he the last pope or something? No, that was John Paul. Sounds like a rapper. I think that might be Sean Paul. Finally, I asked a friend of mine in southern Utah, apparently notorious as a haven for extreme politics, who informed me Ron Paul is a congressman from Texas competing for the Republican presidential nomination. A little embarrassed at my ignorance being exposed in an arena I usually keep up on, I buckled down to watch some of the debates and other desultory political coverage online. Ron Paul was fascinating, a true anomaly in the political gallery. He really practices and votes what he preaches. Doctrine's quite fantastic compared to contemporary mainstream political agendas. At one point during the South Carolina debate, Paul argued for non-interventionism, endorsing the inconvenient truth of blowback, a term used by the CIA to describe cause and effects of foreign policy. Paul's argument upset Mayor Giuliani to the degree that he demanded that Paul retract his statement, since it implied that the U.S. might have prevented the September 11th attacks if it had a history of better foreign policy in the Middle East. Characteristically, Paul refused to compromise on statements he believed to be true. Later in the debate, when candidates referred to and approved of torture in an extreme hypothetical situation from the moderator, calling it enhanced interrogation techniques, Paul labeled it newspeak, a clever allusion to George Orwell's 1984. Most of the excitement Paul generates appears online. After each debate, online polls showed a surprising margin of people favoring Ron Paul after the first debate located in California. In an online poll by MSNBC, Paul finished first in every category except most rehearsed answers and avoiding the questions. Paul finished second in the South Carolina debate, according to a Fox News poll, garnishing 25% of the votes, quite an impressive feat for a man faring only around 3% in telephone interviews. In the New Hampshire debate, Paul once again outpaced his opponents, again finishing first. This time, however, the poll was CNN's in all but two categories: snappiest dresser, which was Mitt Romney, and most disappointing performance went to Rudy Giuliani. Paul's huge internet popularity has sparked quite a controversy. Some claim his supporters are simply so passionate that they are spamming the polls. Others say his supporters merely use the internet as a medium for communication because mainstream media mostly ignores Paul. And there are others who believe his message of liberty is inspiring enough to common people to get them to do something. It's difficult to find traditionally political ad hominem criticisms of Paul. This is actually an incorrect statement here. He served in the Vietnam War as a flight surgeon. He served in Korea in the Vietnam War era as a flight surgeon, and I think in other places around the world too, but was not in Vietnam, and has been a well-liked physician around his home district for decades. He has earned the nickname Dr. No around Capitol Hill because he has so consistently refuse to vote on anything against his constitutional principles. Paul even refuses congressional pensions. A common criticism against Dr. Paul is his constant no votes against awarding congressional medals. However, upon some investigation, he still conducts himself in a much more philanthropic way than his colleagues in Congress on the subject. House records show Paul's disagreement is not with awarding the medals, but the cost of the medal and ceremony to the taxpayer, sometimes as much as $30,000. Whenever he feels the medal is deserved, he offers, instead of using tax dollars, to contribute 100 of his own money, always asking if any other representatives will match him. One instance, after they all refused, Paul commented, "It is, of course, easier to be generous with other people's money." So what? What does any of this mean for American citizens? Well, most experts believe it is a long shot for Paul to win the Republican nomination, let alone the presidency, so it seems, at this point at least, unlikely that there will be a President Ron Paul in 2009. However, Paul's presence on the national scene is refreshing. He offers a broad spectrum of choices for voters and an example of ideas making a difference without all the backing of multi-million-dollar campaign coffers. Regardless of whether people embrace his political ideology, many are voicing their relief that there are still honest politicians, statesmen after the tradition of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, who both consequently also declined pay for their federally elected offices. John Milton described the perspective that voters should have when considering candidates best when he said, "Though all the winds of doctrine were let loose to play upon the earth, so truth be in the field. We do injuriously by licensing and prohibiting to misdoubt her strength. Let her and falsehood grapple. Whoever knew truth put to the worse in a free and open encounter." Mainstream politicians from both sides of the aisle have been unremarkably dull and similar lately. Welcome Ron Paul to the political grapple. And there's no name on this, I don't know, but it's NetX News, which is apparently some sort of Utah concern there. And that's what I really like to see, these people going, "Who the hell is Ron Paul? Wow, cool, I Googled him and look what I found, guys." That's just great. I can't get enough of that. Okay, now, let's see. Too many things on my list here. Not enough time to go through them all. Oh, I guess I should say this. Front runners in the Republican nomination campaign thing going on right now. Fred Thompson and Rudy Giuliani. You know, this guy Fred Thompson complained that the McCain-Feingold bill wasn't called the McCain-Feingold-Thompson bill, since he did so much to get it passed back when he was a member of the Imperial Senate. Remember that. McCain-Feingold, the Incumbency Protection Act, the law which makes it a crime for you and your friends to try to chip in some money and run an ad on TV within 60 days of the election criticizing your congressman. It also turns out, and I don't really have a problem with this because you know me, I'm completely anti-government, and I take the Harry Brown line that if government outlawed abortion, pretty soon men would be having them. That's how good they are at doing their job. Fred Thompson was a lobbyist for abortionists. Again, not that I care, just pointing out the hypocrisy there. You know, I disagree with Ron Paul on the abortion issue to some degree, although I think if you watch his interviews at Google, he gave some pretty enlightened answers to the question and whatever. But at least I know he's honest, and at least I know that he's a baby doctor who's delivered 4,000 babies for a living and that he has real moral principles at stake in his position. But Fred Thompson is supposed to be the new conservative hero, and he's a lobbyist for abortionists? And who knows? I need to pay better attention to the people digging into Fred Thompson's past. But I bet it only gets worse from there. And oh, but yeah, we don't care. Yeah, we're conservative, right-wing, American voters, and we don't care if our conservative right-wing hero is an abortion lobbyist, as long as he promises to slaughter Arabs, which, of course, Fred Thompson does. He's made a solemn vow. And Rudolph Giuliani. This guy's not even a Rockefeller Republican. He's to the left of that. He's for gun control. They'll never take my guns. Oh, wait, Giuliani's for taking my guns? Well, I guess I'd let Giuliani take my guns because, of course, he promises to slaughter Arabs. So I still support him. Giuliani, who made his career prosecuting businessmen for making people money? Well, he is a gun grabber, and he thinks that the role of the U.S. Attorney's Office is to prosecute people for being capitalists. But he promises to slaughter Arabs. Oh, what's that you say? He calls himself a Planned Parenthood Republican? He thinks that tax dollars should be spent on abortions? Giuliani does? And he's a gun grabber? Well, but he is for slaughtering Arabs, right? You say he made his entire reputation prosecuting people for being businessmen? Planned Parenthood Republican gun grabber, huh? Well, he was there that day, and he promises to slaughter Arabs, so got my vote. This is apparently the thought process of the right-wing Republican voter in America. Funny, because the soldiers seem to prefer the guy who wants to bring them home. The soldiers saying, hey, look, endlessly slaughtering Arabs isn't good for anything, and it's just getting me and my friends killed. They've donated more money to the anti-war Republicans so far than all the rest of the pro-war Republicans combined running in this presidential election. But I guess, you know, as long as they're over there and aren't back here telling their friends and family what they think about it, the average conservative, gun-owning, anti-abortion, presumably pro-capitalist conservative voter in America will prefer a Fred Thompson or a Giuliani who stands against all of their principles as long as he promises to continue slaughtering Arabs. That's good going out there, guys. Good thinking there. Okay, it's time to pick on Bill Kristol. I hate to say it, but I'm going to read through this Arianna Huffington thing for you here. I usually can't stand Arianna Huffington, honestly. But in this case, I tried to read the Bill Kristol thing, and I only could just scan through it, and I just can't. I can't do it. I have to give Arianna Huffington credit. She has the patience to sit and read William Kristol, you know, all the way through. In the Washington Post, somehow, I don't know if she's eating Xanax all day or what, her head does not explode. But my head would explode. I don't eat pills, you know. My head would explode if I actually, like, forced myself to read all the way through to the end. But anyway, Arianna Huffington's done me the favor of parsing Bill Kristol's recent op-ed in the Washington Post. She's called it Bill Kristol on the Train to Delusionville. Arianna Huffington from the Huffington Post. I know it's a pretty high bar, but Bill Kristol, the founder of the Project for a New American Century that spawned the Iraq War, the man whose editorials often seem to be inserted directly into the president's speeches, and who once boasted that Dick Cheney does send someone over to pick up 30 copies of the Weekly Standard every Monday, has now just written the single most deceptive piece of the entire war. The charitable view is that he's lost his mind. The less charitable view is that he's now officially surpassed Dick Cheney as the most intellectually dishonest member of the neocon establishment, the highest of all high bars. The truth-shattering piece appeared yesterday on the front page of the Washington Post's Outlook section. It is entitled, Why Bush Will Be a Winner. writes Huffington. I had a preview of this deluded triumphalist drivel a couple of days earlier. On Thursday afternoon, specifically, even more specifically, I was on the 4 p.m. Amtrak. Acela? Sounds about right. Acela? From New York to Washington. Crystal was sitting a row behind me, talking on his cell phone with someone who apparently shared his optimism. Precipitous withdrawal really worked, I overheard him say, clearly referring to the president's use of the term in that morning's press conference. How many times did he use it? 3, 4? Crystal asked his interlocutor, and the conversation continued with a round of metaphorical backslapping for the clever phrase they had come up with. I, of course, have no idea who was on the other end. Tony Snow, perhaps? After all, he and Crystal were colleagues before Snow left Fox. But whoever it was, the emphasis during their conversation on the significance of the clever phrase has been emblematic of the White House prepping of the president. Instead of sending their boss out with real facts or logical arguments, Bush's aides and their friends, see Crystal, concoct some nonsense phrase in the spin lab, hand it to him, and tell him to go out there and repeat it as often as he can. The latest is precipitous withdrawal. It's the new cut and run. It's actually not all that new. Back in January 1969, Richard Nixon used it again and again in his famous silent majority speech. The precipitate withdrawal of American forces from Vietnam would be a disaster, not only for South Vietnam, but for the United States and for the cause of peace. Again and again throughout the speech, Nixon used the phrase to paint the nightmarish consequences of a precipitate withdrawal from Vietnam. Almost 40 years later, George Bush is using the slightly tweaked precipitous withdrawal to paint his own nightmare scenario of what will happen if American forces leave Iraq. And for that, apparently, we have Bill Kristol to thank, at least partially. In an interview with David Carr in March 2003, Kristol sounded just as pleased with himself and with his president as he's sounding today. Quote, I'm a little amused but pleased, he said, that the bus has become more crowded and that it is headed in the right direction. Well, the bus is a lot less crowded today and a lot more dilapidated, but Crystal remains as confident as ever that he and Cheney and their other neocon friends are still steering it in the right direction. It is truly incredible that, at this late date in the Iraq debacle, there are still people who believe that a few well-focused grouped phrases will change the tragic facts on the ground. Again, this is Arianna Huffington at the Huffington Post. My chance encounter at the 4 p.m. Amtrak was a glimpse into their thinking. Crystal's Washington Post piece is the entire Bush-era conservative brain laid bare. It isn't pretty. In fact, the Washington Post should have put some kind of warning on the piece for pregnant women, heart patients, and anyone with an allergy to bullshit. And if the pipeline from Crystal to the White House works the same for this piece as for precipitous withdrawal, the country is in even worse shape than we thought. So what did he say? I'll take it in order and focus on national security. After allowing that the war has been difficult, he writes that, quote, we now seem to be on course to a successful outcome. Really? Not only does he give no evidence for this, not only does he ignore all the overwhelmingly contradictory evidence, he also conveniently neglects to even define what a successful outcome would be. Then comes an onslaught of lies from Bill Kristol. The war in Afghanistan has gone reasonably well. Afghanistan is in fact teetering on the precipice of chaos. Indeed, 2006 saw the highest number of coalition deaths since the war began. The next highest before that, 2005. The Taliban is making a comeback and unrest among Afghans is growing. Obviously, Crystal's definition of reasonably well is very different than the experts. Then he's on to Pakistan, where according to Crystal, quote, Al-Qaeda may once again have a place where it can plan, organize, and train. No fault of Crystal and his neocons for taking the military to Iraq instead of getting Zawahiri and bin Laden. But according to the National Intelligence Estimate, there is no may about it. This is not a future possibility, but a current reality. And in what is unequivocally one of the greatest failures of the Bush administration, the National Intelligence Estimate report concludes that Al-Qaeda is better positioned to strike the West than at any time since 9/11. But no worries, because according to Crystal, These Waziristan havens may well have to be dealt with in the near future. I assume Bush will deal with them using some combination of airstrikes and special operations. Hear that? We're apparently just going to sort of casually start bombing Pakistan. That's the sort of thing that would make me nervous if I thought Crystal had any pull with the White House. Oh, wait. Then on to Iraq. Just imagine what would happen if we hadn't gone in. Saddam Hussein would still be alive and in power, and, I dare say, victorious. Victorious? What does that mean? This, according to Crystal, he might well have restarted his nuclear program, and his connections with Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups would be intact, revived, and even strengthened. Ah, yes, that old completely discredited warhorse, the Saddam Al-Qaeda connection, rides again. That'll no doubt be high on the set list when Crystal and Cheney are still touring with Bush Mania in 2012. Then, putting aside his future delusions, Crystal treats us to his current ones. We are routing Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That is, Sunni Iraqis are routing Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We are beginning to curb the Iranian-backed sectarian Shiite militias, and we are increasingly able to protect more of the Iraqi population. Actually, a growing percentage of the Iraqi population is no longer even in Iraq. Since we invaded Iraq, around 2 million Iraqis have left the country, with another 2 million still there, but having fled their homes. But Bill Crystal is just warming up. Now he starts to swing for the fences. The fact is that military progress on the ground in Iraq in the past few months has been greater than even surge proponents like me expected, and political progress is beginning to follow. Huffington responds to that, "Preposterous. What political progress is he talking about? The fact that the Iraqi parliament is about to take the month of August off? Even President Bush's own mixed bag interim report on the benchmarks found little or no positive movement on political goals. Gosh, Bill, how can we keep this great success going?" Crystal, "It would help if the administration would make its case more effectively and less apologetically." In other words, they should be repeating more of the clever phrases he sends over to them. Also, "It would help if Bush had more aides who believed in his policy, who understood that the war is winnable, and who didn't desperately want to get back in or stay in the good graces of the foreign policy establishment," i.e., more people like Crystal. "If the president," Crystal concludes, "stands with Petraeus and progress continues on the ground, Bush will be able to prevent a sellout in Washington." What does he mean by sellout? Is he already dusting off the stabbed in the back theory from Vietnam? That, of course, we could have won if only the soldiers hadn't been stabbed in the back by the media and anti-war liberals. Which is so freaking preposterous. And to look at the DOD documents that show that they knew they couldn't win in 1961. I'm sorry, is your argument, made of too thick a mortar that doesn't affect what you think? I'm sorry, that's my own little tangent. I just can't stand that. It's the media's fault that Vietnam was lost. Yeah, you know, we killed 3 million of them, and you know, it would have been great if only somebody hadn't said it wasn't great. Anyway, sorry. Back to this stupid thing in the Huffington Post here. Crystal has plans for the next president, too. Following through to secure the victory in Iraq and to extend its benefits to neighboring countries will be the task of the next president. Extend its benefits? Hear that, 2008 GOP presidential candidates. Bill Crystal thinks you should run on a platform of "I pledge to take what we did in Iraq to even more countries around the world." For Crystal, quote, "What it comes down to is this. If Petraeus succeeds in Iraq and a Republican wins in 2008, Bush will be viewed as a successful president. I like the odds." "I'll take that bet," Huffington writes, "and you can too. Crystal would be sitting in for an online chat at the Washington Post Monday at noon." Oh, well, this is old and we missed it. I wonder how that went. I bet it was fun. "I got an idea. Now, you know I'm not usually for conscription or really for Congress doing anything. And I know that bills of attainder are explicitly outlawed by the Constitution, which allows the Congress to exist in the first place. But I don't care. The Constitution doesn't mean anything to anybody anymore anyway, right? So how about this? How about a law that anybody who writes for the Weekly Standard or the National Review has to go patrol Iraq in an aluminum Humvee? I mean it. I want to see Bill Kristol forced at bayonet point to join the army and go fight over there with the Apache squad and see how he likes it. Don't you think that'd be hilarious? A bunch of Weekly Standard guys got blown to hell today by the Iraqi resistance, 1% or so of which are Al-Qaeda foreign fighters who had nothing to do with Iraq until after the invasion. Who would shed a tear? Who would shed a tear if a PFC Kristol got blown to hell by an IED like so many young men are having to go through over there in Iraq? That's just me. I'm a little cranky. You know, I actually saw a funny clip yesterday on MSNBC. Chris Matthews had on a group of people, and this one little snot-nosed Alex P. Keaton, little should have been wearing a bow tie, little fuck from the Weekly Standard, was on there, and Chris Matthews said to him, yeah, you know, if there was a draft, I think your loose lips would be a lot more quiet in all the shit you talk promoting this war. And the little Weekly Standard punk completely sank in his chair and looked down at his desk in shame. Pursed his lip, or is purse the right word for it? Where you like kind of bite on both of them, suck them in? You can't see your lips because they're like inside your mouth, kind of folded over sort of thing. You know what I mean? And, you know, Chris Matthews wasn't even really trying to bust him that bad. He just said, yeah, well, you know, I think if there was a draft and you had to go fight this war you promote so much, Weekly Standard boy, I don't think you'd be so loose lips about it. And, man, it was like he had hit him. Should have seen. It was hilarious. Well, that's my modest proposal. Force the men at the National Review and the Weekly Standard to fight. And in fact, keep them over there until they're all dead. I don't know. That's probably not too good for my demo tape, right? Also in the news, George Bush has come up with the solution for problems in Israel and Palestine. That's right. He's going to put more support behind the Fatah movement. And that's going to, I guess, grant them legitimacy or something. And now, you know, you have to go back and look at the fact that Fatah, the secular communist types, the PLO, Arafat's group, they were willing to come to a reasonable settlement on many different occasions. And the Israelis wouldn't have it. And the Israelis, in fact, created, deliberately created Hamas. And this is not a conspiracy theory. This is documented all over the place. Start with Richard Sale and UPI. Israel deliberately created Hamas to be a right-wing, religious, crazy alternative to the secular communists of the PLO. That's where Hamas comes from. And now here, Bush and the Israelis demanded that the Palestinians hold elections. They withheld all the tax money that the Israelis collect for the Palestinians and wouldn't give it to Arafat. So he couldn't buy up any votes at all. At that point, he was already seen as a puppet of the West anyway, but now he couldn't even buy up his votes because the Israelis wouldn't give him any of their tax, you know, tariff returns and what have you. And so Hamas won the election. But we can't deal with Hamas. Even though it was America that demanded, that created, well, Israel that created him in the first place, and America and Israel that demanded that elections be held. And basically, deliberately or otherwise, probably otherwise, set it up so that Hamas would win the election. Through their own stupidity, really, I think, is the only explanation for that. Although, I was reading Jonathan Cook on Vineyard Saker's blog. It's vineyardsaker.blogspot.com. And he did an interview with Jonathan Cook, who I believe is a British journalist who lives among the Palestinians, not in Israel, but in the West Bank. And what he said was, there's a deliberate policy to radicalize the Palestinians, to divorce them from any secular movement, and make them, you know, basically create the image around them that they're all just a bunch of crazy people with black masks over their face and AK-47s who are completely irrational religious fanatics who cannot be dealt with. Because if they cannot be dealt with, then there's only one way to get by, and that is kill them, butcher them, build 30-foot walls across the middle of their property, smash their society into little pieces. And I don't know whether George Bush is in on any conspiracy here, or if he was, whether he would know it or not. But George Bush announced another $200 million to the Palestinian Authority, to the secularists, which of course only decreases their legitimacy and empowers Hamas, which fits into what Jonathan Cook describes as the plan, as the model. Support the crazies, punish the moderates, push the crazies until they act even crazier, and then say, look, these people are crazy, we can't deal with them. You have a war on terror, we have a war on terror. As though Israel hasn't been occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip since 1967. Anyway, here's Jim Loeb, a major policy address Monday by U.S. President George W. Bush promoting a two-state solution for Israel and Palestine has been greeted with considerable skepticism by Middle East specialists. Most analysts said Bush's speech, including his pledge to provide $190 million to support Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and convene a regional conference to support renewed Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, was too little, too late, and included too many conditions to rally strong Palestinian or Arab support. The speech, which came on the eve of a new trip to the region by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, marked Bush's full embrace of what has been called West Bank First strategy. He calls for providing full support to Abbas on the occupied West Bank while isolating his main rivals, former Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh and his Hamas party, which took over the Gaza Strip last month after a series of gun battles with security forces loyal to Abbas's Fatah. Bush said Washington would provide Abbas and his new government, headed by Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, with nearly $200 million in mainly economic assistance, including humanitarian aid for Gaza, as well as an additional $80 million in non-lethal aid for his security forces. He also announced that Washington will convene an international meeting chaired by Rice later this fall to promote both internal Palestinian reform and the bilateral peace process that could offer Palestinians a political horizon for the achievement of a viable and contiguous state of their own. I ought to be paying attention to what I'm reading here instead of spacing out. So I will call together an international meeting this fall of representatives from nations that support a two-state solution, reject violence, recognize Israel's right to exist, and commit all previous agreements between Israelis and Palestinians, Bush said. And never mind the fact that Hamas offered to recognize Israel as long as Israel would recognize them in the election that Israel forced them to win. And the answer, of course, was no. So, yeah, here's Bush. So I will call together an international meeting this fall of representatives from nations to support a two-state solution, reject violence, recognize Israel's right to exist, and commit to all previous agreements between Israelis and Palestinians, Bush said. The conflict in Gaza and the West Bank today is a struggle between extremists and moderates, he said, insisting that Hamas's recent takeover of Gaza demonstrated beyond all doubt that it is more devoted to extremism and murder than to serving the Palestinian people. Well, that's just a damn lie. It was America that started that civil war in Gaza, supporting Fatah to kill the Hamas guys, and they lost. It's like blaming the Branch Davidians for the dead ATF, who started a battle they could not win. Oh, wait, that's what they did. They blamed the Branch Davidians for that, didn't they? Oh, sorry. He added, George Bush, the worst president since Woodrow Wilson, who's so full of shit, he ought to have exploded by now. I can't understand how anyone can stand to be near him. The stench of death that's got to follow him around like a halo. This worst president since Woodrow Wilson. He added that Palestinians now face a moment of choice between the vision of Hamas, chaos, suffering, and the endless perpetuation of grievance, and the vision of President Abbas and Prime Minister Fayyad of a peaceful state called Palestine as a homeland for the Palestinian people. What bullshit. Worst president since Woodrow Wilson. Worse than Roosevelt. Worse than Truman. Worse than Nixon. Worse even than Bill Clinton. George W. Bush, the worst president since Woodrow Wilson. There's no doubt about that. I don't know if you went back and really counted, at least, you know, since TV's been around, I bet you George Bush has told more lies in any given year as president than all the rest of the presidents probably combined. Everything he says is a lie. Everything he says is just some BS talking point from Bill Kristol, apparently. There's no truth to anything he ever says, ever. His every premise for his every assertion is false. How can anybody still put up with this? 29% approval rating for this president. Where are you people? Do you not have the ability to put letters together into sounds and then put those words together into sentences and, you know, absorb meaning from them? Is 29% of the population of this country completely illiterate? The vision of Hamas is death and destruction. The vision of Fatah is doves and peace. And olive branches and love. Which I guess leaves John P. Walters, America's drug czar. Because, of course, this is Russia and we like having czars here in America, don't we? Makes him only the second most dishonest politician in America this week. This is from Reading.com. The nation's top anti-drug official said people need to overcome their reefer blindness and see that illicit marijuana gardens are a terrorist threat to the public's health and safety as well as to the environment. John P. Walters, President Bush's drug czar, said the people who plant and tend the gardens are terrorists who wouldn't hesitate to help other terrorists get into the country with the aim of causing mass casualties. Walters made the comment at a Thursday press conference that provided an update on the Operation Elysia marijuana eradication effort. Don't buy drugs. They fund violence and terror, he said. After Turin Gardens raided this week in Shasta County, California, Walters said that the officers who are destroying the gardens are performing hard, dangerous work in rough terrain. He said growers have been known to have weapons, including assault rifles, which, of course, we know used to mean actually fully automatic rifles and now means any scary-looking gun that the government wants to take from you. But, of course, that's why they don't ever use the word fully automatic, because that means what it means. It's a self-defining term. Assault weapon can mean anything they want, of course, and that's why they use that instead. These people are armed, right, like all Americans, and in fact all human beings on Earth have a natural right to be. Is that what they are? Armed, huh? They're dangerous, he said. He called them violent criminal terrorists. Walters, whose official title is director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, said too many people write off marijuana as harmless. We have a kind of reefer blindness, he said. No arrests have been made so far in the 4 days of raids. The opening leg of what Shasta County Sheriff Tom Bosenko, welfare recipient, tax collector, has promised will be at least 2 straight weeks of daily raids. He said suspects have been hard to find because their familiarity with the terrain makes it easy for them to flee quickly. Although crews doing the raids are using Black Hawk and other helicopters. Oh, but believe me, there's no chance at all that any of the helicopter manufacturers do any lobbying for the war on pot. Just put it out of your mind. Although crews doing the raids are using Black Hawk and other helicopters to drop in on some of the gardens, Bosenko said they don't want to give the growers any warning of a raid. We try to move in under stealth, he said. And anyway, I'm all out of time, but there you go. If you smoke pot, you are a terrorist. If you smoke pot, you're the kind of person who would help other terrorists get into the country to perform mass casualty attacks against the American people. You damn pot smokers. You know, first you got the jazz musicians toking a little reefer and going out and raping every white girl they see. And now look at you pot smokers inviting Al-Qaeda into America to kill people. Boy, it's a good thing there's no evidence whatsoever for those assertions, or else, you know, that would be really bad. Be really mad at you people for your acts of treason. But, oh, okay. It's not true, so it's all right. All right, I'm out of time. That's Anti-War Radio. Sorry for screaming in y'all's ears for a couple hours there. You didn't mind too much, right? The wonderful interview of Bill Brown will be up on antiwar.com later today. Thanks for listening. See you here tomorrow. 11 to 1.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene. Give the audience a grin. Enjoy it. It's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit. When you look at it, life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show, keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Records available in the foyer.
Right.
Some of us got to live as well, you know. Alright, it's a lot. Let's get this place up there.
Right.
Change his mantle within 3 weeks. What do you think pays for this rubber? Never made the money back, you know. I told him. I said to him, Bernie, I said, they'll never make that money back.